The following podcast is sponsored by SuperheroStuff.com.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Timothy Harvey, and I'm sitting across from Mr. Jason Hunt.
Yes.
And we are here at this week's episode of H2O, in which we discuss this, that, the other thing, and a couple of those things over there.
For the next 50 episodes.
For the next 50 episodes. Because we have, this is 51.
This is 51. Welcome back.
Yeah, this is kind of cool. So we thought we'd actually talk about something that Jason saw in Popular Mechanics.
Yeah, Michael Okuda, who was the art director for Star Trek The Next Generation, did all the signs, you know, the stuff that's, you know, lists. I remember one in particular it was an engineering sign, and it was a safety sign on the side of some device or something, and the safety rules: you don't tug on Superman's cape,
right?
Don't spit into the wind, you know, those kind of things. And then of course you'd have the McFly grave in that one episode where Dr. Crusher was seeing the ghost, played by Duncan Regier.
Right.
Nobody was supposed to see that McFly headstone, but they did. But yeah, Michael Okuda. He's done a lot of stuff with NASA, done a lot of graphic design, logo design for various missions for NASA. Posted on his Facebook page a link to this article in Popular Mechanics. It's dated February 15th, and it is by Stephen March. "Star Trek: The Next Generation Was the Future We Deserve," is the headline. Subheadline: "Brave New Worlds Have Been Replaced by a Google Chip." And in this article, I'll just read the beginning of it. I'm quoting here from the article. "The future was better when Star Trek: The Next Generation was making it. The show went off the air 20 years ago this week and has definitely dated, as science fiction shows always do. The special effects look hilariously crude now." I could disagree a little bit on that. "The acting veers from the ridiculously high," Patrick Stewart doing Shakespeare in space, "to guys walking around in makeup," Michael Dorn is Worf. "But what dates the show most is its optimism. It was the last pop culture show that believed, beyond any doubt, that human beings were good, and that liberated by infinite technological progress, we would encounter an infinitely wonderful universe. Our current emotions about the future are decidedly mixed, partly because we are so much more immersed in technology than we were in 1994. Here is a quote from Sergey Brin, one of the founders of Google, about the glorious future technology is bringing into our lives, from Stephen Levy's In the Plex, How Google Thinks, Works, and Shapes Our Lives. And he quotes Sergey Brin here. "Ultimately, I view Google as a way to augment your brain with knowledge of the world. Right now, you go into your computer and type a phrase, but you can imagine that it could be easier in the future, that you can have just devices you talk into, or you can have computers that pay attention to what's going on around them and suggest useful information." Google co-founder Larry Page adds, "Somebody introduces themselves to you, and your watch goes to your web page. Or if you met this person 2 years ago, this is what they said to you. Eventually, you'll have an implant where if you think about a fact, it will just tell you the answer." And he goes on to talk about this future that is much more of a possibility now because of all of the technology that exists in the world.
Sure.
And the fact that none of it's positive anymore. You look at our science fiction, you look at our futurism shows, and none of them paint a picture that was as optimistic as Star Trek The Next Generation. I mean, even if you look at Deep Space Nine and Voyager, those were darker, especially DS9. You know, and more especially going toward the end of that show.
Sure.
With the war and everything. But Voyager is not not a very happy show. I mean, they're lost in space 70 billion bajillion light years from home.
Without Will Mummy.
Yeah, exactly. Or the robot.
Yeah.
No comic relief at all. Except,
not even Dr. Smith.
Well, they had the doctor.
Yeah. But,
the holographic doctor.
Yeah, but...
But still, I think this article raises a valid point. Does the genre find itself lacking any kind of optimism? And this is something we talked about a little bit on Echo Chamber a while back, where the group mm-hmm. got together and we talked about the fact that dystopian future stories were so prevalent now.
Yeah.
And I made the point there that I am so sick of them because it's all we get.
Yeah.
There is no, I mean, we're even seeing it now in the DC movies, the DC Comics movies. You know, Superman is not a hopeful, positive, optimistic character in Zack Snyder's world, and I don't like that much.
Well, I think there's a couple of things that we're running into here. First is a problem with story. And I think that a lot of people look at, because the thing about dystopian futures is that they are really good for setting up a conflict. And of course, conflict is an important part of story. Even if you are telling a happy story, there's a conflict in there somewhere because life is full of conflicts. Sometimes they're very, very tiny conflicts. It can be the conflict of, do I have time to do my laundry or do I have to go to work first? You know, I mean, and seriously, I mean, it's you know, life is full of conflicts on tiny, tiny levels to very, very large levels. Romantic comedies are all about a conflict. Every story is about conflict.
Well, story is.
So you, when you're telling science fiction stories, there's a grand history of telling big idea stories. And the problem with big idea stories is that they tend to want to have big conflicts.
With lots of explosions.
With lots of explosions, because explosions are cool. But the thing about having big conflicts is that the easiest way, and I guess this is sort of a crisis of laziness, and this is not a, and believe me, there are some amazing, amazing writers who have done some great dystopian stuff. Do not misunderstand what I'm saying here. I'm not calling them lazy, but I'm calling them lazy because it's easier.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. And
it is.
And that's not necessarily a bad thing. You can have really good dystopian stories. I mean, Walking Dead is got the ratings numbers it has for a reason. And that's because about half the show is really good and half it's terrible. But it's hugely popular.
Would you categorize Walking Dead as a dystopian future,
yeah,
though?
It's a dystopian future. It's a post-apocalypse story. Even as the show is on the air.
Because I keep seeing dystopian, whenever I think of dystopian future, I always go even further into breakdown of civilization.
Right.
Society is rearranged and reorganized in ways
so far you're Walking Dead,
are completely antithetical to any human nature at all.
So far you're on Walking Dead,
All right.
Well, and this most recent episode, and this is spoilers for the kids at home.
Spoilers.
Is an example of that because you have our heroes have been through the ringer. Every time they've encountered any significant group of people outside of their group, it has ended in blood. Whether it's been, in a way, naivety for the events on the farm, or the leader is a psycho with the town of Woodbury, or
all of the above.
Or all of the above in Terminus, where basically, you know, the people who have basically said, come to us, it's a safe place, are cannibals. And the thing is that even the cannibals are trying to convince themselves that it's okay because
they don't feel they have a choice.
Well, except that every time they turn around, you hear one of them saying, we didn't used to be like this.
Right.
I'm going to eat you now, but I want you to understand we didn't used to be like this, which of course makes it all okay. So that when Rick and company encounter someone who is looking at them and saying, no, really, we're good people. We have a safe place. Please come and we'll see if you can be part of us. We're not telling you you're going to be. We're going to say, maybe you can be part of us because we're going to audition you.
And you're and if you're not going to be part of us, then you're going to be part of us.
Well, no, these guys are saying...
I mean, like, we'll eat you. You'll be part of us.
But that's what... But these guys are basically like, no, really, we're honest to God. We just want you to come and see where what we've made. Mm-hmm. And nobody... You know, Rick doesn't want to believe him because he's so terrified of the danger, potential danger to his group, his family, that even, you know, God above could descend down and go, it's going to be okay. And he'd go, I'm not so sure.
Yeah.
And because he's so burnt. And he in the character, his a hopeful future is just not something he can envision. I think you run into when you run into so much of this science fiction that is, you put humans in extremis, you know, and I don't mean the Iron Man subplot.
Right.
you can get some really great stories out of pushing us up against a wall, backing us into a corner, and then we come out and we save the world, or we save ourselves, yeah, or we save civilization. But the thing is that the story, the part about building the new world is the boring part.
But at what point does it no longer have as much impact to be telling the same kind of stories over and over and over and over?
Oh, I don't know. What's your feeling on what's that show that's based on the video game that's on Sci-Fi that I don't watch?
Oh, Defiance.
Okay, what's your view on Defiance? Okay, there
you
go.
But let me qualify that hate, because it's not. It's a combination of things.
Mm-hmm.
There are some interesting elements of the show.
Mm-hmm.
I think Tony Kern and what's her name? They play the Tars.
Right.
They tech Tar. That whole thing, they're aliens.
Jamie.
She's
Jamie Murray.
Yeah, thank you. They are distinctly non-human. Mm-hmm. Whether they're humanoid or not, their behavior and their attitudes and the whole world building around that race, that species, I think it's very interesting, because you're not just putting human emotions into a humanoid and putting some sort of a makeup appliance on their nose, like Star Trek did.
They spent their time actually developing an alien race.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. And if we had the Daytac Tars show, then maybe it might be more interesting. But you take the combination of the dystopian future, which it at least has a in-story logical explanation with alien invasion destroys everything,
mm-hmm,
rather than we just killed ourselves and destroyed the planet. I don't know how many times we've seen that trope. But it's that, but it's also the fact that this show is a blatant commercial for the video game.
Right.
And the story sucks. I mean, it's just a badly written show.
Right.
And it's full of tropes, and it's full of stereotypes, and it doesn't work on so many levels.
Mm-hmm.
Not just the whole dystopian future thing that I'm sick of seeing. It's a common, it's that, but that's the foundation to everything else that doesn't work in that show. Because I think when you get right down to it, you have to acknowledge, as a writer, as a storyteller, and I put this out there in the universe at large, and I'm challenging science fiction writers, you have to acknowledge that at some point you can tell a happy story in the future. You can. It is possible.
Do you know what I want to see?
What do you want to
see? What I really want to see? And I want to see this so, so very badly. I want to see a series based on us getting off the planet.
Pern.
No. I mean, I want to see a series based off of us getting off the planet in the near future. I mean, like, asteroid belt. Like, colonize, you know, build.
Funny you should mention that. My kid, well, this was many, many moons ago now. He was 5 years old at the time. He's 13 now. This was 8 years ago. Mm-hmm. In February of 2005. Mm-hmm. We had just gotten word that J.J. Abrams was going to reboot Star Trek. Mm-hmm. And my five-year-old looks at me, because we'd been watching a lot of the fan films. We'd been watching Phase 2 and Exeter and those kind of things. And he looks at me and he says, let's make a new Star Trek. It's like, well, there's this thing called copyright. We wouldn't be able to make any money. And sure, yes, fine. You can make a fan film. And now that we've got Starbase Studios down in Oklahoma City, it's even more possible that we could go and make a fan film. Sure, fine.
Yeah.
But I looked at him and I said, okay, well, what if we made our own Star Trek? What if we made a brand new story? Mm-hmm. He says, okay. I said, what's it about? And he sat there in the dining room and he looked up at the ceiling and he says, it's about a light that turns people into eggs that melt after 5 minutes.
So I was wondering where Gene Roddenberry was going to be reincarnated, and apparently it's in your
case. And I thought about that, and I thought, okay, how do I make that work? out of that discussion, we came up with an idea that now spans, it was back when web series were just coming into their prime.
Sure.
And people are still trying to figure out how to make money doing it, but you could do this serialized 10-minute episodes, chapter one, chapter two, chapter three, like Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon and stuff. And I thought this was perfect for this. And we started it in the asteroid belt. Mm-hmm. And then we go out to Alpha Centauri. Mm-hmm. And it's not Star Trek, it's not Star Wars, but it's in that sandbox, stylistically. Right. And you can, mix in a little Battlestar Galactica, a little Babylon 5 and whatnot, gangsters and thugs and smugglers and whatnot. And the egg that turns people in, the light that turns people into eggs became a power source device.
Mm, okay, sure.
That doesn't work. Mm. It actually malfunctions to the point where it turns people into protoplasm.
Okay.
It turns them into eggs, and it melts, right? Okay. So now you've got people that want to turn it into a weapon. But we're still not in dystopian future. This is, it's crime. It's a crime story more than it is, overthrow the man type of thing. And, and of course, I've got the Zatanna pitch that I still want to throw out there, but that's not in the future.
Right.
But it makes me wonder, because we've got ideas for stories that would span four or five feature-length stories and some short films and whatnot, all set in this universe. And I can't think that I'm the only one out there that's come up with something that's not a dystopian story.
Well, I tell you what, you're not. And there are still authors who are doing it. And some of them are of varying range. I always like to recommend Jack McDevitt.
I interviewed him one time up in Omaha at Ozfest.
His science fiction novels are full of conflict, but they're conflicts on a scale that the conflict is bigger than all of us. Mm-hmm. And so you just have to live your life and do the things you're going to do.
Which we do.
So, exactly. Yeah. So you have this, because the universe is, the galaxy is under threat of these, ancient alien machines. And mankind is trying to figure out how to do something about it. But in the meantime, we got to go out and fly our ships from point A to point B and do the things we've got to do. And so you live your lives. Yeah. And so it follows basically primarily it follows a lady named Priscilla Hutchins. But anyway, I highly recommend these science fiction series because you've got your conflict.
Right.
You've got your big dramatic space opera thing, but it's in even though it becomes the centerpiece of several of the stories because it's the part of the larger story, mm-hmm. most of the time it's kind of in the background. It's just people doing the things they have to do.
Yeah, I wonder... if some of that, at least in terms of our fiction, our filmed media fiction, has been driven by budget stuff. Because if you look at, I was reading an article that was in TV Guide this last week. Features a lot of the comic book shows, but it's also got an article in there on Survivor. 30 seasons of Survivor.
Oh God, I know.
15 years that show has been on, and the impact that reality television has had on the industry, and the budgets, and the advertisers, and the audience, and everything's got to be done on the cheap now. You see the impact even with. What was it that Sci-Fi just did? Ascension.
Right.
It's basically a bottle show.
Mm-hmm.
You build the sets and you shoot the show.
Sure.
And there are no special effects in that movie. There aren't any spacescapes or alien world except the last at the very end. I mean, there's some visual effects.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with the powers and the explosions and whatnot, but you don't have ships flying through space. You have a model.
Mm-hmm.
You have a 3D. You've got a 3D CG model,
mm-hmm.
and you see bits and pieces of it every now and then in a cutaway shot.
Right,
and that's it. Well, there's no flying through space. And I wonder if there's a combination here, because in this article here, in 1994, technology was a part of our lives, but it did not dominate us completely. So it was possible for Star Trek TNG to imagine a world in which we as people stayed much the same, but the worlds in which we traveled expanded infinitely outward. Technology for the past 20 years has relentlessly driven inward. This is true in pop culture as much as in real life. William Gibson's concept of cyberspace, the fantasies of Neal Stephenson's in Snow Crash.
Mm-hmm.
Not Brave New Worlds, they're transformations of consciousness, changes in the nature of the soul. He's got a point.
You
look at what Google has done. You know, you've got Google Glass, where it's all right here in your face,
mm-hmm.
and we are all connected.
Yeah, but there's
way too much.
There's a couple things about that. One, Google Glass is also dead, essentially, because it.
But see, you got this guy from Google seeing a time when we've got a chip in our head that tells us what's going on.
Oh,
now,
but we've been talking. Well, we've been talking.
Have to worry about the heat, but
science,
still,
yeah, science fiction. Where does that heat go?
Yeah,
it's always an issue.
Goes out the ears.
Well, it just depends on what your goal is.
Right.
Oh, we cooked his brain. Never mind. But you know what? We've known to some degree that we were going that way anyway. We've known that way for a long time. Because that's been part of the science fiction too. Is the computer,
yeah.
The computer, the internal computer, the part, the you know, the but
right.
The,
but if you read, you know, you read Heinlein, you read Asimov.
Well,
you read
but there's
Bradbury,
also there's also a couple of things that I think we have to be honest about. These, especially those guys, a lot of that stuff was coming after World War II,
mm-hmm.
and basically they just came from what we have never ever had to go through.
Right,
what literally was a world war, you know, for all the fact that you know we hear about it far far more than we used to. The disturbing reality, in a kind of a positive way and in an odd way, is that statistically we're killing less of ourselves than we used to. We hear about it all the time.
Yeah, because you know, the media loves that.
Well, because
if it bleeds, it leads.
You know, that's William Randolph Hearst. I mean, this is not news.
Right.
This is not this news ain't new.
Yeah.
But the thing is that generally speaking, as a species, we're doing a lot better job. We're still doing it in way too many numbers. Don't, you know, but we're killing less of ourselves, which is great. That's a good thing, right? We're living.
One would think.
One would think we're living longer. We're living better. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. These are all positives. But post-war...
Some would argue, though, that the Internet has not made everything living better.
Well, the Internet...
I would be one of those.
But see, so much of this stuff is... Again, we saw this explosion. We saw that, you know, so much of... The people who shaped science fiction, the people who were giving us these brave new worlds,
mm-hmm.
these amazing visions of a universe... We're doing it pre-Apollo. for the most part. The
pre-Sputnik, even.
Yeah. So they were doing something that we all do, and it tripped up Enterprise bad when it was on the air.
Yeah.
Is that the technology that we have now outstripped Star Trek, aside from the warp drive and the transporters?
Right.
We have my cell phone is you know I et cetera, et cetera.
I
mean, you know,
I saw a cartoon the other day. Kirk and Spock standing on a street corner with their communicators out, and everybody was like, "All you do is call people with it. Nice. You can't do anything else with it."
Yeah, and I think so. We this weird thing happened, which is we had this amazing moment where we envisioned a future that we could not foresee happening.
Right.
And then we discovered something. We're living in it.
Yeah.
And
where do we go from here?
Well, this becomes a great thing and a negative thing, because you suddenly have shows like Enterprise where, wait a minute, it's how far in the future? And the technology looks a lot like what we've got right now, except you've slapped on a warp drive.
Right.
I think in many ways that's why you end up with these things like the Google guy talking about the future, is that we've seen these jumps happen so quickly. We've seen in our lifetimes they have got cars now that drive themselves, and they are looking at this stuff and they are saying that if the technology works the way that every test is showing that it works, if we all switch to these cars that drive themselves, automotive fatalities are going to plummet. Okay, can you imagine? Yes, you know where we saw. You know where we saw discussions of cars like that. Popular Mechanics, 50 years ago, 60 years ago, 70 years ago. So much of the future
is now,
and at the same time, what didn't happen is we didn't get a big, gigantic societal change. The world stayed the same. Now it's the world plus all this technology.
Right. People didn't get any better.
People didn't get any better. They didn't necessarily get any worse either. They're just still people.
But a lot of the optimistic futurism society stuff, a lot of it assumed that all of this highfalutin technology would make us better humans. Make humanity better. It would enlighten us. It would give us all of these avenues to improve ourselves. And we've seen that's not the case.
Well, remember that was kind of the conflict between a lot of the writers and Gene Roddenberry of Star Trek.
Yeah.
Is that Gene was insistent that the world be this bright place where people had no need of money.
Well, and it was even worse in Next Generation was worse in than original series, because Roddenberry insisted on none of the core cast of characters have any kind of a conflict. They had to get along all the time. It's one of the reasons why everybody said that the Enterprise was the floating Hilton.
Yeah.
Because it was bland. It was vanilla. There was no conflict. All of the conflict came from outside.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of outside, we have to go outside. Well, we don't have to go outside.
It's cold outside. I'm staying in here with the coffee.
We're going to go to a break. We are going to get some more coffee, and we are going to take a break. Let you hear a message from our sponsor, SuperheroStuff.com.
They have some great stuff over there.
They do. They do have some great stuff. And we will be back to talk a little bit more about the future as written and the future as we'd like it to see. Like to see it. Let me use my words. Right after this message from Superhero Stuff, and we will be back when H2O continues. Stand by.
You're listening to H2O on Sci-Fi for Me Radio.
Okay, Tom, try it now.
SuperheroStuff.com.
One more time.
SuperheroStuff.com.
Well, we want them to visit superherostuff.com. So maybe a little bigger.
Superherostuff.com.
There we go. That really gets in your head, doesn't it?
Hey everyone, Leslie Walker of Sci-Fi for Me here, just to give you a little reminder that our super smart crew members share their thoughts weekly on the DC shows Gotham, The Flash, and Arrow. Check out our podcast where we discuss these shows and story arcs, character development, plot twists, misses, and wins. Or if you'd rather check in for a quick recap read, we have you covered there as well. So join us for some DC-flavored morsels at scififorme.com, your portal to the science fiction multiverse.
Sci-Fi for Me Radio, transmitting by the power of Grayskull.
And if I may, call your mom. Everybody. I'm told it's like a billion people or so. Call your mom, call your dad. If you're lucky enough to have a parent or two alive on this planet, call them. Don't text, don't email. Call them on the phone. Tell them you love them and thank them and listen to them for as long as they want to talk to you. Thank you. Thank you, Mom and Dad.
J.K. Simmons,
mm-hmm.
in his acceptance speech at the Oscars,
yes,
Best Supporting Actor for Whiplash, saying, call your parents because all this technology crap is just not a good enough. Get personal.
Well, I think you want to do.
And that, well, that goes back to our conversation before. You know how the internet has made everything impersonal, has disconnected us, and I think that's a step toward this dystopia that nobody has any real connection to anybody anymore, and that plays into that future where we have no interpersonal relationships that matter much mm-hmm. anymore. I mean,
well, I think that in a broad sense you can say that, but I think that also we have not reached the point, and I don't really honestly ever seeing us reaching the point where we don't want to be around other people. I mean, individual people will, obviously. That's
I don't want to be around people.
See, a case in point. But yeah. I think that, you know, it's a two-edged thing. Yes, it can, you know, I greatly, greatly bemoan the loss of the letter.
Mm-hmm.
Because you had to think about what you were going to write.
And you had to be good at writing, and yeah, handwriting was a thing.
But you know what you never see in Star Trek? Hmm. Nobody ever writes anything.
No, that's not true. Because I know Catherine Janeway.
Okay.
I mean, she didn't write.
All right, but look at the people. Look
she
at
dictated.
The, okay, see, dictated. But I mean, yeah. Nobody writes anything. So somebody was talking about, I can't remember, it was an article or someone was talking about the demise of cursive.
Yeah.
You know?
It's in the same garbage can with spelling and grammar.
Well, but spelling and grammar is still being taught. The question is. But of course, then we were into the deeper question that English is such a bastard language. It is taken from every other language on the planet
right.
to serve its purposes.
But there's still such a thing as correct spelling.
Oh really? You want to have the British and the Americans discuss that?
Well, I mean,
because they'll argue with
those
each other.
In the United States, things are spelled a certain way. In Britain, they're
now,
spelled a different way.
Now, but the thing is that, of course, it changed because it all came from British English, and you see this, and because
right.
languages
but
evolved.
I still don't see us going to ask anyone a question anytime soon.
Well, okay, but then regional dialects turn into that sort of thing.
That's not a regional dialect. That's lazy.
Well,
that's lazy talk.
Some of that does come out of regional dialects.
No.
Depending on where you are, yeah. I mean, but some of that stuff, you know, you go around the United States, and there are places in this country, and you don't think about it so much because it's such a big country, and we're so used to hearing the guys on television who are all Canadian, who speak perfect, and they are. I mean, there's a lot of our newscasters, a lot of actors. Canada exports people with very neutral accents, which is the
bland Midwest accent,
right?
Is
which is very, very popular.
I've run into that myself mm-hmm. because I started college in Oklahoma City,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of people were surprised that I grew up in Texas,
right?
Because I don't sound like I'm from Texas.
You don't have the twang.
I don't have the drawl. I do say y'all. And sometimes I do, you know, I can sound, you know, I sound like I'm from the South the more tired I get. But I grew up watching the news. Sure. I grew up watching, you know, various different television shows and whatnot. And I just never, I mean, my parents, you know, my parents are from Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
And they sound like they're from Arkansas. Sure. I mean, my mother especially. You can tell she's from the South.
Right.
And there's anything bad with about no, but, that. But it's just, you end up with, you know, you recognize it. Mm-hmm. But I don't sound like I'm from anywhere near the South.
No.
And people are very, very surprised at that. And I you know, dialects and things, what ways we say things, you know, that's another part of that. You know, futurism, you know, projecting forward into how things are done, because I'm reading the Dragon Riders of Pern series again now. And it's interesting to see how Anne McCaffrey has evolved the language, the certain ways that people say things throughout throughout the narrative, from the time they landed on Pern to the, you know, the Master Harper Pern in the later stories. And it is really interesting to see how language changes.
Right.
But you don't have any, I don't know exactly where I'm going with that. You don't have any real need still, I mean, that communication barrier that the internet presents, at the same time it eliminates.
Right.
It is like what you say. It's very much a two-edged sword.
Yeah.
Where, yeah, it's great that I can get in touch with people from, you know, high school and college and people that live, you know, 1,000 miles away from me. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there are certain people that I'm in touch with that I don't necessarily want to be in touch with all the time.
Well, you have to be in touch with them.
I know.
You have choices. You don't have to accept the friend request.
In particular cases, I do because you know you get in the.
Well, but I think that's, you know, here's the flip side of the Star Trek future, for example, because it's the easy one. Okay, it's the one we so much of us have familiarity with and we grew up with it.
Because it's nice to think about a future where we all get along.
Well, yeah,
sort of,
to some degree, and yet at the same time, you look at that future, and God, it's so. Everybody speaks English. Everybody is kind of the same. No, I'm not. You know, there's a. And
you're not going to bring white male privilege.
No. But it's. It's there was a reason. You had something like when Blade Runner came along, and you got this polyglot of languages,
right?
And people sat there and went, "You're right."
Well, Firefly did the same thing.
Oh yeah, exactly. So you're more likely to but Blade Runner was one of the earlier ones to do it, where you look at suddenly you realize that we're not going to end up in this melting pot where English is going. I mean, English certainly in so many ways is the international language. No doubt about it.
Certainly for science.
You know, certainly for science, for a lot of business.
Yeah.
But not all of it. There's a lot of different ways, you know, that English has proven itself to be a very effective language as being useful across the globe. But slap 400 years on to humanity now, and English is going to resemble our English now probably about the same way that it resembles Old English.
Right.
Okay.
On that April, we
will recognize pieces of it. Yeah. It will sound familiar, but we will sit there and go, "I don't know what they're saying."
Yes. I want to divert a little bit into news this week.
Mm-hmm.
If you would remember our conversation, speaking of technology,
yes.
You would remember my prediction that Google was going to be Skynet.
Mm-hmm.
This article in TechCrunch. Dated, it's today.
Yeah.
We're recording this on a Tuesday, the 24th of February. Google acquires Facebook marketing startup Toro. Now, this is not a Facebook company.
Right.
This is a company that develops advertising and marketing specifically to Facebook.
Okay, sure.
Okay, so it's a piece of something connected to Facebook-ish.
Right.
And this just goes back to my prediction. Google is one step closer. Because now they bought the mobile ads. This is going to fold into their mobile ads division. But this is their foot in the door to Facebook. And Google is going to buy Facebook. Did you see, I passed this along, there was a article on the Mary Sue about the petition to get...
Stop whitewashing
Ghost in the Shell.
Yeah.
I found it really interesting down in the comments, and this goes back toward what we had been talking about, and it actually ties in with what we talked about last week, too. They were talking about Akira, because apparently that's still a thing. And you talk about, dystopian futures.
Yeah.
Excuse me. They're talking about, making that one with an American, setting it in New York-ish,
yes.
Something with an American cast, and everybody's just bemoaning the fact that this is still a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's like, how are they going to do it? Because Akira was so connected to the whole nuclear war thing, because it's Japan, and it's, Nagasaki and Hiroshima and all of that. It's like Godzilla. It's an anti-nuclear thing. And somebody put in the comments, they'll 9/11 it.
They'll 9/11 it? What does
and
that
that'll
mean?
That'll be the entry point story-wise. Instead of nuclear war,
it's I see.
Big, massive terrorist attack on New York thing.
Here's a better idea.
Don't do it.
get a Japanese cast. Get a Japanese director. Get an American studio to help throw some money at it. And make it a joint production, because they have those now.
Yeah, but,
and then give us a film that can play in the international market in Japan and America.
But they're not going to do that.
Well, that's where the money is. I mean,
but they're not going to do that.
But that's where the money is.
Because if it's a Hollywood picture,
yes, because American audiences don't want to watch people who don't look like them, even though nobody, the world looks like everybody else now because we all come in different colors.
I just don't want to see an Akira. I think the one that we've got is perfectly fine. There's no reason to do it again.
I think that if you're gonna do it, because now the special effects are there, you can't, right? So you can.
Yeah, and but that doesn't necessarily mean that you should.
No, that doesn't necessarily mean that you should. But if you're going to do it, recognize the fact that some stories come out of important cultural things.
Mm-hmm.
There's a reason why the American Godzilla, the Matthew Broderick, Jean Renault, Jurassic Godzilla, Godzilla yes. Park,
right,
and Godzuki 2, which I swear to God, if we got a puff of smoke out of those little things, I was going to be like, oh, of course it is. There's a reason it didn't work. And that's because it forgot that something like Godzilla or Akira, or a lot of those stories, there's a cultural reason for those stories being effective.
Although that touchstone wasn't necessarily much in Gareth Edwards' Godzilla.
I mean,
you still had the nuclear power plant and all of that, but you didn't have the nuclear proliferation.
No, but you could. But you had in your Japanese characters, you had. I think you ended up with a sense of they were aware of the history.
Yeah,
because they.
I mean, you did have all of the Bikini Island stuff and all of at the beginning.
And then it became, it was a monster movie. But at the same time, there's an importance to understanding the context. And I think that Akira, yes, could you tell in a story set in America with the same plot of Akira?
Yeah,
but you know what?
We did.
It was called Chronicle.
That's a good.
That's the American Akira. And honestly, they should leave it that way. Because
I wonder if anybody else has thought about that.
I hope so, because it's obvious, because it's basically...
doesn't necessarily mean anybody actually thought about it.
But I mean, in many respects, it is. I mean, because I don't think 9/11, for all the importance of 9/11 to us culturally, and I'm not for a second going to diminish the impact on individuals and families or anything like that, 9/11 does not compare to having an atomic bomb dropped on your city.
No, it doesn't. But
and it doesn't. Two atomic bombs dropped on your country.
Yeah. But I do think you look at it in terms of cultural significance. Outside of World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, all of these actual war settings that the United States has been involved in, we have never been on the receiving end of anything that massive of an attack.
No, we haven't. And
I think that had an impact, emotional impact.
Oh, sure, of course it did.
But I think, too, and this has been pointed out on a number of message boards and bulletins and comments and whatnot, 9/11 does have, I think, an influence in the kinds of stories that we've been telling. Because
You
look post 9/11, and our futurism stories especially go darker. And I think the proliferation of the dystopian future doesn't necessarily come out of 9/11 as it's, you know, by itself. There are a number of things, but I think 9/11 factors into that. And then Christopher Nolan.
Well, one thing Americans realized, and American audiences realized, is that we were very, very lucky because we had an ocean, two oceans, in between us and a good chunk of the world.
Right.
So we weren't going through what Europe was going through. We weren't going through what, you know, Western Europe. We weren't going through what Russia was going through. We weren't going through what, you know, the Asia or the Middle East or Africa or any of those things. Because all those folks were on top of each other. You know, if your country next door decides to invade you, say you're Iraq and Kuwait, okay, your little tiny Kuwait,
yes,
and Iraq decides to invade you
again,
you sit there and go, well, holy crap, they're right there. If Japan decides to invade America, or I'm sorry, let's make a reference to a really, really terrible unnecessary remake. If, say, North Korea decides to invade America.
My kid was asking me about that the other day, because we were talking about, because the Wolverine's war cry has shown up in Phineas and Ferb.
Oh, okay.
Wolverine!
Sure.
Like, what does that mean? What is that? So I tell him, it's from this movie called Red Dawn. It's about the Russians invading and, you know, all of that. He said, can I watch it? No. No, you cannot watch it. Why not? Because it's rated R and you cannot watch it. It's not something that you can see yet. And then we got talking about the fact that I mentioned there was a remake of it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, can I watch that one? No. Why not? Because it's not appropriate and it's bad.
Yeah. It's just a bad movie.
I was like, there's really no reason why they even should have made Red Dawn.
No, but you look at some of the stuff and you realize that, you know, for us, I don't want to get into larger scale politics kind of things on this, but the real effectiveness, I think, of 9/11 was that we were attacked with our own stuff. We weren't attacked by another country per se. We were, you know, and it wasn't like other countries' planes came over to attack us.
Right.
They were our own planes, right?
Yeah, they didn't drop bombs on
us. And so I think there was, and you saw some of this after 9/11, where for all the great sympathy we were getting around the world, for every
which didn't last very long.
No, it didn't. But for all the very positive reactions, there were voices that were saying, well, you know, we deal with this stuff all the time.
Right.
And you know, we're sorry it happened to you, but welcome to the world. You know, you guys have had it easy. And to some respects, as horrible as that sounds, to some respects we did. And because we were isolated. When you're, you know, we were isolated, you know, we didn't have to worry about Canada.
Right.
Canada has not shown a tendency to invade lately. South America, Mexico and South America have their own issues to deal with.
Although some would argue that we are getting invaded from the South.
I don't even think we are. But we've had an ability to be safe because we've to many respects
geographically
we've been safe, which is a barrier, and that's something that enabled us, I think, in many ways to have a sense of positive, a positive future that, say, if you're living in London and the IRA is bombing, mm-hmm. or you're living in Catholic or Protestant Ireland, you may not necessarily have that sense of positivity,
right?
Because you're afraid that, you know, the Catholics are going to bomb you or the Protestants are going to bomb you or whatever. You know, I mean, it's you end up with a mindset that maybe doesn't have that optimism. You look at a lot of British science fiction coming out of World War II. London had been bombed repeatedly. A lot of the science fiction coming out of Britain, and not all of it, obviously, but a lot of it was fairly dark.
Yeah.
You look at a lot of British television, Survivors, Quatermass, early Doctor Who in some cases. Blake Seven. There's a darkness to it, which is...
Well, even Red Dwarf.
Sure.
I mean, you're looking at the last surviving human mm-hmm. in the universe mm-hmm. after... plague, war, famine, death,
sure.
you know, disaster and stuff.
So I think that in many respects that isolation, which of course is almost non-existent anymore because we are connected in the way that we are. Mm-hmm. Geography is now becoming just a matter of numbers.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's okay. It might take me a long time to get there, but I can talk to you right now. You know, the sending the letter across the ocean mm-hmm. on the boat and takes a month to get there isn't, you know.
Yeah.
I'm going to call Jason. Jason, I'm in wherever.
Yeah, and the only thing separating you is a time zone.
Exactly. And roaming charges.
Well, you know.
And those are going away.
Those are going away. Yeah, not even that anymore.
Exactly. Well, so. And I think that you end up with this thing where I honestly think we could have a resurgence of positive. Or at least an optimistic future. It's going to be a different optimistic future. It's not going to be Star Trek.
You say that,
yeah,
and then
I do
we
say
get,
that.
And then we get this Power Rangers fan film
mm-hmm.
that shows up today.
Sure,
with James Van Der Beek and Katie Sackhoff.
Yeah,
and technically it's pretty well done.
Yeah, okay,
it's very great.
Impressive.
I mean, it's one of these where, and it goes back to. I don't want to blame Christopher Nolan, but it goes back to this whole idea of reimagining things as grim and gritty and dark. And
well, but the guy who produced it pointed out that he had spent the 90s watching Power Rangers and X-Men cartoons.
Right.
And he did something, I think, and you and I were talking about this actually before we started recording, because I had not seen, I'd watched the first half of it, and then I watched the second half before we started recording, but... a lot of the shows that were aimed at kids, if you think about them in real-world counterpoints, you know, just think, okay, what, this was happening in the real world.
Right.
They're ugly. I mean, they're messy. I mean, you know, think about it. The Smurfs. Look, here, watch me reach this one here, okay? The Smurfs, all right?
Uh-huh. I think I know where you're going with
okay.
that.
Okay. Gargamel? If this was a real guy,
yeah.
this was a real human being, we're not even going to talk about the movies because I'm talking about the cartoon series.
Yes.
The movies never happened.
What movies?
I don't even know.
What?
If they were to make that a real thing, you know, this is a guy talking about genocide. He's wiping out a species. That mm-hmm. is his plan.
A species so, which is all male.
It's a very curious species. Oh, yeah. And he invents...
He invents the female.
He genetically engineers a female to be a... to destroy them. This is kind of creepy. So you don't... So yeah. The thing is, you don't think about this stuff too much because it's stuff aimed at kids. What they did with the
The Lost Saucer. Look at the Lost
yeah.
Saucer.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you get two robots in a spaceship that uh-huh. come down to Earth and kidnap two teenagers and take them off.
Yeah, that's not good. It's very bad.
And never bring them back.
Exactly. So you don't think about this stuff. So what they did was they thought about what kind of world would it be if you were basically recruiting essentially child soldiers.
Yeah.
And giving them powers and then sending off to fight a war.
I'm waiting for the fan film that crosses over this version of Power Rangers with Ender's World.
Well, honestly, they could fit in. They could fit in
to
some degree.
You could do that.
Yeah.
But see, this goes back to like reimagining Battlestar Galactica, and reimagining Bionic Woman mm-hmm. and Knight Rider. Well, not really so much Knight Rider, but Bionic Woman and Battlestar Galactica and all of these shows from way back when,
mm-hmm.
making them dark. and gritty.
But there's a couple.
And at some point, it becomes really old.
Well, I think
I want to see something different. I want to see something new. I don't to see. I'm tired of the shows and the stories and the whatnots that show me a future that is bleak. My present is bleak enough. I don't need.
Oh, I understand. I
don't want to look forward to.
I'll loop it back around. It's like they look at the conflict, and they look sit there and instead of recognizing that conflict needs to be a part of the story, they make it the story.
Yeah.
And I think here's what I want to see. I want to see a show about us going, hey, we got off the planet.
Let's make that show.
We escaped the gravity well. Let's go out and let's go to the asteroid belt.
Let's go see what's out there.
Let's go see what's out there. And the thing is that you said it 50 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
You don't go any further than that because I don't need another show where I'm looking at the technology is instantly dated.
Yeah.
Because you go to, they have these guys, they're called futurists. You go to one of these guys and say, 50 years. Give me a cell phone 50 years from now. What is it going to be?
You know, on your watch.
You know, it's going to be on your watch, or it's going to be a little tiny headset that hangs off your glasses, or something. It's going to be right there. You know.
Yeah.
Am I going to have a chip in my head? What's it going to do? You know. And
how do you keep the heat from burning up your brain?
My brain. So
I feel really hot all of a sudden. you feeling that?
Yeah. So and then give me 50 years where you know SpaceX. Mm-hmm. Has done it where one of our administrations has dumped the money into NASA, so we're at Europa. You know, give me that.
What's
stuff.
That company? We can't land on Europa. What's that? What's that company now? There's a company.
No landings.
Gold,
here.
Golden something. That's specifically their goal is to establish.
Oh, the colony on Mars?
Mining operations in the asteroid.
Oh, no, yeah, those guys.
I can't remember their name, but yeah, we linked to them in a story at one point way back when. But as a matter of fact, it was a Week in Review, I remember, because we rolled a clip from their demo video. And their whole thing is not space exploration. It's not go see what's out there, go meet aliens, or, you know, dig ditches in Mars and, you know, find the water or anything. It's go to the asteroid belt. And mine it for resources.
Sure.
That's their whole thing.
Right.
And ultimately, they want to be the way station where, you know, on the way to Mars, on the way to Pluto, the way out to Alpha Centauri or wherever, they become the supply depot and whatnot.
Yeah.
And that actually kind of plays into the story that we had come up with, that James and I had come up with, about the asteroid belt being a place for industry.
Do you remember I posted it to Facebook a while back. I think a lot of people did. It was the video that's got Carl Sagan talking about the big blue dot, and it shows us going out into the solar system. And it's a beautiful vision. It's a beautiful thing of let's go. And I think there's a series there. I think there's stories to be told there. And honestly, I think there's an audience for it because as much as I love, you know, the new Mad Max movie's coming out. Talk about dystopian future.
Oh, no kidding. Yeah.
And I'm looking at that going, I want to see that so bad because it looks like it's going to be.
It's made out of candy.
Exactly. And you sit there and go, yes. And at the same time, my brain is big enough. I can hold two competing thoughts in my head because I'm a human.
Well, Star Trek is not even futurist optimist anymore after the reboot.
Well, we don't know what the third one's going to be because the third
it's be junk.
Because
you
the second well because
be.
The second one ends on this whole point where I mean, that's the point of the ending of the first one is we've gone here and let's go out and explore the stars and the music swells and. And if the third
that's how
one,
they ended the first one.
Well, but if the third one is go out and explore the stars, which has slightly higher chance now that Simon Pegg is one of the writers. But the thing is that if that's what happens, then I'll be sitting there going, "Thank you," because you can do that because an audience for Star Trek is primed for that, and that would be an easy way to do it. When I say easy way, I don't mean like as in like. You know, not thinking about it too hard and taking the path of least resistance. That's the easiest way to sit there and get that audience excited about that again. But what you really need is something like an AMC or a Showtime or an HBO or a Cinemax sitting there and going, we're going to put the money and develop, not a sci-fi channel, as much as I would love to see them, and I love the fact they're talking about getting back into science fiction. Oh. Ascension is not giving me warm, fuzzy feelings about this. And I would love to be wrong, and I will happily let them prove me wrong. But give me one of these big cable companies that have proven that they are willing to spend money on big show, on you know, 8 episodes of really high-quality television.
Well, and even now, you know, the fan films being the way they are, with the effects that they've they've got, they've proven that you don't have to spend a gajillion dollars granted, all these guys are doing it for free.
But you know what you do?
And if you paid for it, it would cost much.
But just like the model, the True Detective model, or
The following,
you end up casting big name actors in these short run series, and so that's how you get your audience. So give me a show where these people sit there and they go off, and it's 50 years from now, and mankind goes, right, let's go see what the solar, because you can keep it in the solar system, so you don't have to go. You know,
you could. I had an idea for a show one time that would basically play with this whole reality show scenario that we keep having to deal with.
Yeah, I don't watch them.
And well, I don't watch them. I end up getting I end up getting work.
Of course.
So I have to deal with it at some point.
I've worked on a reality show too myself. So.
But this idea I've got is called the Astronaut Farm, which is basically if we set a fake reality sequence where we're in the training facility for people who are learning to be astronauts.
Okay.
And you can mix a little bit of real and fiction and whatnot, but you could set that 40 or 50 years from now.
Oh, sure.
And play with, what would it take? What kind of people would be the ones to go out there and explore and to see what's on the other side of the horizon and stuff? Let's just find some people with some money. You got a Rich Uncle Otto yet?
No.
Let's find Rich Uncle Otto and say, Rich Uncle Otto, give us all the monies so we can make these shows. Because, you know, eventually somebody's got to make them.
Yeah,
it might as well be us.
No, that's true.
Why not?
So, folks, if you want to give us money to... We actually do have a button.
On our website.
You know, I think here, at the end of the day, it's all cycles. It really is. I think that Westerns were a thing and then they weren't.
Mm-hmm.
Superhero films are a thing. Guess what, folks? I hate to break it to you. At some point in the probably not that distant future,
probably about 2025 they'll go.
Yeah,
out.
Maybe 10 more years. Superhero films are going to be like, I want something else.
Yeah,
and then maybe it'll be and science fiction films are hit and miss, and sometimes they're really good, and you get things like Gravity, and you get things like Interstellar, and all these little there's real positive things there. It's gonna happen. We're gonna have these looking outward. Adventure movies. I
wonder what Tomorrowland is going to be like.
I don't know.
You know, there's still that question of what that story is going to be.
And I give them credit. They're doing a really good job of not telling us.
Yeah.
Which is kind of like, you mean you're not going to give us some hints?
Was that a jetpack?
What are you doing?
What was that?
I require extreme a significant amount of advance information before the film.
Spoilers.
And they say, no.
Did you see... And before we get out of here, I just wanted to touch base on this really quick. Did you see the rumor that, to talk about spoilers, that J.J. Abrams has expressed frustration over the fact that we've gotten so many spoilers that have come out and the leaks and stuff on Star Wars Episode 7? So much so that he's apparently asked Disney to move the release date to May of 2015.
No, I hadn't heard that.
It was Movie Pilot and one other website. Now, Movie Pilot, take it for what it's worth.
It's
hit and miss what they were saying.
Sure.
But apparently somebody overheard Abrams complaining at the Visual Effects Society Awards about all the leaks. And somewhere the story has come out.
Didn't he also just recently say that there's so many different rumors about Star Wars.
Some of the rumors are right. Some of them are true, or some are not. But according to this story, and who knows how accurate it is, because it's Movie Pilot. But they've said that he's asked Disney, and Disney is seriously considering moving the release date to May of 2015. Now that would do three things. One, it would make the internet explode.
Oh yeah.
Two, it would get us back to the traditional release date for Star Wars.
Yeah.
Three, and this would be the big thing, this would be the deciding factor as to whether or not Disney would actually even remotely consider this, would be whether or not they think it would have a negative impact on Avengers Age of Ultron. Because Age of Ultron comes out May 1st.
Right.
And if they lead May with a big super tentpole blockbuster billion-dollar movie,
mm-hmm.
and they end May with a tentpole super blockbuster bajillion-dollar movie,
mm-hmm.
what is that going to look like? Are they going to... Are they going to negatively impact each other, or are they going to break all sorts of records for May forever, for all time, ad nauseum, forever?
Well, I think that you run the risk of May collapsing into a quantum singularity and punching a hole through reality as it's going to happen there. And we can't do that because the last day of May is my birthday, so we cannot destroy the world.
No, not until June 1st.
Not until June 1st.
All right.
No, June 2nd, give me a chance to recover.
Okay, all right. And we will give all of you a chance to recover from this episode. We'll give you a week, and we'll come back for another one. In the meantime, if you have any thoughts on any of these discussions and digressions that we have every week, you are certainly welcome to leave a comment or send us an email, h2o@scififorme.com. We do read every note that comes our way. And in the meantime, visit superherostuff.com.
Oh, yes.
For all of the latest stuff. And you can connect with us on the social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Pinterest, Google+, YouTube, Tumblr. I knew I was missing one. And and as always, we invite you to subscribe to all of our shows. We've got a number of podcasts here as part of Sci-Fi for Me Radio. Besides this show, we have Level 117 talking about the Marvel Cinematic Universe. We have the Rogues Gallery talking about the DC Cinematic Universe, including all the television.
We just had a Rogues Gallery go live on the website. You should check that out.
We did, yes, where we're talking about the Firestorm pilot. And
otherwise known as the latest episode of Flash.
Yes. And then also, of course, Sci-Fi for Chicks. They're talking about Gotham and Sleepy Hollow over there. And the Weekend Review, which is over at Sci-Fi for Me TV, our YouTube channel. That is our weekly digest of all the news that is news, as much as we can pack into a 15, 20-minute show. And... yeah, and then all the latest stuff you can find over at scififorme.com. That's going to do it for us this week. We will be back next week with another topic. Tim Harvey.
Always a pleasure, sir.
I am Jason Hunt, and we will be back in 1 week's time.
This has been a presentation of scififorme.com. Copyright 2015 by Flaming Dog Media, LLC. All rights reserved. No portion of this program may be retransmitted without the express written consent of Flaming Dog Media. This is Sci-Fi for Me Radio.